So, we're going to have to, we're going to have to return to these traditional forms of living. And I was associated for quite a few years with the New Urbanist movement, because I wrote those books that were critical of suburbia and proposed a remedy for them, essentially in traditional towns. And the New Urbanists did perform a very big service to America by jumping into the dumpster and retrieving a lot of lost knowledge about how to design and assemble a human habitat. And just, you know, just this afternoon in Eugene, when I landed here, you know, I've been sitting on a plane and in airports for most of the morning, and I got up and walked around town. And, you know, it was remarkable to see what a poor job you did of designing and assembling the actual core of Eugene. Actually, what you're seeing there is a lot of missing stuff, stuff that was destroyed and is no longer there, and has been replaced in the post-World War II period by just unbelievable crap. if this stuff had been proposed in the time of our great grandfathers, they would have thought that they were looking at a future of universal mental retardation. You know, buildings so unworthy of the human spirit that they just boggle your mind. But we're going to have, you know, we will learn how to do that better again, and for a number of reasons. One will be that we're going to be moving through it slower. You know, one of the things that you did in Eugene, I'm really surprised that you're still doing it, because this is supposed to be a hip town, you know? And you're still running all your streets as one-way streets, or at least most of them. You know? That's one of the stupidest things you can do in terms of just, you know, the rules of town planning. Because and especially when you remove the parallel parking on the sides of the street. Because it automatically turns every street in your town into a mini freeway. Because cars will not travel according to the posted speed limit. They will travel according to the handling characteristics of the road. And if the road informs you that it's okay to drive 50 miles an hour, even if you're in the center of town, that's exactly what the cars will do. The fact that you've allowed your traffic engineers and city officials to keep your streets one-way streets is just amazing to me. You know, you're supposed to be much more progressive here. So you've got to change that. That's one of the things you've got to change. And that's one of the kinds of rules that the New Urbanists had retrieved from the garbage can and had put into operation, back in operation all over the country, in the places that will allow them to do it. So I hope you'll do that here, because the one thing that you do have here that's a really good thing is that you have a good, highly structured urban grid of interconnecting streets. That's the key to it, is that they interconnect. And you know, you have a lot of opportunities where frontages on the street, you could actually drive a lot of alleys through the middles of your blocks and perhaps even new streets, especially small and intimate new streets, and that would benefit you tremendously. But anyway, so we'd have to do that whole thing differently. So all of those things, the way we do farming, the way we do business, the way we do schooling, the way we live, the way we do transportation, these systems are all going to have to be really reconstructed in a very fundamental way. And, you know, we've been sleepwalking into our future. We're not prepared for what we're facing. And I'm going to close by just saying this to you, and then we'll do some comments and questions if you want to stick around. If you don't want to stick around, slip out as quietly as you can so as to not disturb the people who do want to stick around. But one question that I get repeatedly, especially in university audiences, and I'm aware of the fact that, you know, most of the people here aren't students, you know, you're grown-ups for the most part. But, you know, during the actual school year when there are kids around, and you know, kids are very idealistic, and they're, you know, they don't like to feel pushed into a state of despair. And they always say to me, can't you give us some hope? Can't you give us some hope? You know? And I think there are a lot of reasons to be hopeful about things that we could do if we wanted to, if we had the will to do it. In fact, it reminds me of another one of the stranger experiences I had over the last 10 years. back in the days when I was doing the urban design stuff, I went to a conference at Yale called The Future of the American City. And all these eminentissimos of planning got up at the podium, and they all said the same thing. We must give self-esteem to the poor people in the cities. And so then it was my turn, and I said, we should give cocaine to the poor people in the cities. Because it makes you feel great about yourself without accomplishing anything. That's how stupid progressivism was in the 90s. That's how ridiculous we became. And as a registered Democrat and a putative progressive, I say that, I fully believe that the progressives in this country have made themselves ridiculous, every bit as ridiculous as the neocons. But here's the answer, Here's the answer. The hope has to reside within you. And the way that you access that hope is by understanding that there is a distinction between wishing upon a star and actually putting your shoulder to the wheel and making things happen. That there's a difference between wishing and doing, the fundamental difference between being a child and being an adult. That it's not possible to get something for nothing, and that if you want something, there's probably going to be a price that you have to pay, including making alternative fuel. And for a lot of the alternative fuel, the truth is, that it's like the old joke about the Adirondack logger who wanted to make his blanket longer. The dumb Adirondack logger wanted to make his blanket longer, so he cut off a foot from the top and sewed it onto the bottom. And that's what we're getting a lot of. Except what we're getting is we're cutting a foot off the top and sewing 9 inches on the bottom, because there are costs incurred in all of these biofuels and alternative rescue remedy fuels. So the hope has got to reside in you. You've got to make it happen. You've got to generate it in yourself. And the way you generate hope is by building confidence in your ability to contend with reality. And the way to do that is to accomplish one thing after another, starting perhaps with small things and working your way up to the bigger things. And we have to do that. We have to start collectively accomplishing some things. That's why I think it's so important to start with the railroads, because we could really demonstrate to ourselves that we were capable, and we could really build our confidence, which is so badly needed. After 30, 40 years of being turning insidiously into a society of clowns, of overfed clowns driving clown mobiles, eating clown food, we've become extremely demoralized. And we need a boost in our confidence. So that's where the hope resides. We're like people in rehab who need to start putting one foot in front of the other and pulling our pants up and learning how to rely on ourselves again and feel that we can rely on our neighbors and feel that we can depend on our neighbors perceiving reality correctly and not thinking that it's just a matter of kicking back and wishing.
You're listening to a talk by James Howard Kunstler, author of The Long Emergency. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Finner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, KRBS Oroville, The Surge 96.3, Radio Veronica U.S., WYQZ, Warrenton-Bealeton, or WMRW, Warren. We return to James Howard Kunstler as he takes questions from the audience.
So, end of my formal remarks, and I invite questions from you and comments. But don't make too many political speeches. I'll reserve the right to tell you to shut up if you do.
Yeah, Mr. Kunstler, thank you. Thank you for talking about the psychological state, the denial and the delusion of the broad masses of the population. And there's no doubt that you're right about that. But what strikes me is the problem where politicians, corporate executives, and bureaucrats rise up a ladder of success where they're systematically groomed and conditioned to embrace a deeply flawed model of reality. Can you speak to this?
Yeah, I think that it's one of those sort of wonders and marvels of our time, because I don't believe that it is particularly a matter of any kind of conspiracy. What it is, you know, it's a consensus. But it's a consensus that's joined even by the broad masses of the people. The broad masses of the people, for example, who worship Donald Trump on television, and the Wolverine that lives on his head. The broad mass of people who worship Paris Hilton and Nicole Richie. And by the way, as I said earlier, I'm the farthest thing from a Marxist there is. But I think what you'll see is, in very short order, those people are going to be eaten. Donald Trump will be eaten, and this angry public will have Paris to dessert. The little cupcake. I want to say one other thing about the demoralized public. A lot of my friends are concerned with creeping fascism, and especially the idea that George Bush is the next Benito Mussolini. And I don't think that that's where this is going to come from. I think that there is a danger of running into some kind of cornpone fascist situation in America. But it's not going to come from there, I don't think. What you're going to see is this incredibly demoralized public, this vast group of, 200 plus million adults who have spent, the last three decades being just incredibly narcissistic and wasting their time with Las Vegas and internet pornography and eating cheese doodles and, just every kind of stupid behavior there is, NASCAR, all this stupid shit that we do. And they're going to find themselves getting whacked upside the head by a set of circumstances that they can't evade. And they're going to beg for somebody to push them around when that happens. Because they're going to wake up and be so purposeless and so devoid of direction that they're going to beg somebody to push them around and direct their behavior.
I just have to say, what you said has really spoken to me on a real personal level, because I got rid of my TV about a year and a half ago, and I realized that I've been wasting the last 20 or however many years of my life in just what you described as a state of sleepwalking. And I feel like I'm just now starting to wake up, and it's just really, gotten to me how people, it's not just television, it's like the whole culture, the educational system. Everything I read in your book was so shocking to me that I'd never learned it before. And it's because we're all just so groomed to let somebody else do our thinking for us. And, I know one other thing I'd like to say really quickly is that I know a lot of people in this room probably really idealize the sort of return to normalcy, really, that you're talking about is going to happen, but it's definitely going to be a painful process, before the dust settles.
Yeah, I agree. And, when that rug of unreality, that cushion, maybe it's a cushion, is yanked out from the broad base of the public, they're going to feel a lot of pain. I agree with you.
I'm not optimistic. I know what's going on. I have enough property, enough gardening skills to take care of myself. The question I have is, I live in a small city, 100 people. Do you have any suggestions as far as what we could do as a community to pull together and prepare for this strong emergency and to work together?
Well, probably... I think probably one of the most important things you can do is to start really investigating how you're going to generate electric power in your own locality, if you can do it. And obviously there are many ways that it can be done, but as I said earlier, it It's likely to be, finally, a very local thing. And that's going to be a huge local problem, and the sooner that you collectively start having discussions about it, the better. You know, I don't know one locality in America, really, that's having that discussion in any serious way.
We have an insane project in this community called the West Eugene Parkway. It's a highway project that not only wastes massive amounts of money, but would also waste farmland and the rare wetlands that are still left in the land.
Is it a new freeway?
A new freeway, yeah. $175 million is the estimate, which would probably cost twice that, you know, how those things go. But anyway, do you have any suggestions for successfully opposing that sort of insanity?
Probably nothing that you haven't thought of yourself. I mean, I'm not any kind of a, you know, miraculous political organizer. I do think that you're going to see many kinds of psychological overhangs from the old conditions. You know, even as we move into new conditions, and even as the new conditions are recognized, you're going to see a lot of strange, persistent old behavior, you know. And one part of it is you're going to see this desire to keep on supporting the driving infrastructure and adding to it, even when it becomes self-evident that the motoring fiesta is over. As the housing bubble starts to deflate, you're going to see a lot of the realtors and bankers and developers are going to they're going to hang back and wait for the good times to return so they can continue to just do the new 1,000-acre projects of, you know, make houses. Those times probably aren't going to come back, but they're going to hang back for 2, 3, 5 years maybe. You know, they're going to keep on paying the options on those tracts of land that they acquired, you know, until they ruin themselves. So you're going to see a lot of hangover effect of behavior. It's partly that psychology of previous investments. We just can't let go of it. You know, we can't let go of it. I think that we're going to be a significantly less affluent society. We'll have fewer people will be able to pay any kind of tuition at all. And I have serious doubts about whether we can run the kind of mega structures and mega campuses that we've developed. After all, these campuses, in a way, are also expressions chiefly of a cheap oil economy. You know, they grew up and they started in the early 20th century to really assume this kind of scale, and they've been growing especially since the Second World War, and now they've all assumed the size of office parks, giant office parks, with full of megastructures. And, you know, in places where I've been just in the last 3 weeks, I went to the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor about 10 days ago. And, you know, the size of the structures that they are building now for biomedical research and, you know, other disciplines, they're putting up buildings that are half the size of Rhode Island. They don't have any idea how they're going to heat these things, because they were, you know, they got on the drawing board, 5, 6, 7 years ago into the building pipeline. And it's only been within really the last 3 or 4 years that we're beginning to really recognize that we're screwed with natural gas, which is, you know, primarily how we heat stuff and also make electricity in America right now. So I think we're simply going to see tremendous trouble running the campuses. Also, a lot of the campuses are strictly automobile, auto-centric campuses, and especially in a place that you wouldn't imagine, you know. Go to the University of Massachusetts sometime. It looks like a UFO landing strip. You know, the distances are so vast, it looks like Monument Valley between the English building and the science building. And you have the road, the campus roads are the size of, you know, Highway 5. It's very dispiriting. And, you know, it's like a whole campus designed for androids or robots. It's horrible. Way in the back.
If you ride a passenger train from Eugene to Portland, if you take 4 hours, if you sit endlessly on side tracks waiting for the train, somebody told me that there was a parallel set of tracks going on.
Yeah, well, we had the same situation in New York. In New York State, we had the venerable old New York Central Railroad, which I'm sure you've all heard of. It basically ran east to west across upstate New York from Albany to Buffalo. And what happened was the CSX Corporation, which is a big freight operation, just took the second track out. Why? Because in New York State, we have especially punitive state real estate taxes on railroad tracking. A leftover law from like 1903. You know, but that's how stupid we are. You know, that we allow this track to be ripped up because of this stupid punitive tax. And, you know, the result is that there's now only one track, and the freight trains all have the right-of-way over the passenger trains. So every time a freight train comes by, the passenger trains have to step aside on a sidetrack, and a dead-end sidetrack, and just hang by, and then go on their way. But so the result of that in New York State is that you can't take a train from Albany to Buffalo in less than like 3 days. you might as well ride your skateboard there.
Just to kind of piggyback on what Guy was talking about with education, and I asked this of Rupert when he was here a couple of years ago, that those of us that have chosen for whatever reason to pursue education and that maybe are halfway there, it's just, there's this feeling of being torn, like, okay, I might as well just finish. I've incurred all this debt. This is really important to me. And then you also hear this other message where it almost makes sense to throw in the towel and, you know, have a TV in the backyard. And when you have a foot in both worlds, it's like, what the hell?
It's very difficult. I think what you're supposed to do is recognize the difficulty in your position. Because I think you're describing your situation very well and very clearly, and it's very difficult and poignant in part. And, you know, partly you're restating the psychology of previous investments. You know, you've invested, 17 years in educating yourself to be a teacher in a certain discipline, and now you're not even sure that the institutional support's going to be there or the net, the framework for carrying out your vocation may not be there. I don't know. For what it's worth, what I think we'll see at some point, if and when the dust settles, is that a new system of education will sort of grow out of homeschooling, in the sense that I don't think we're going to replace the secondary schools by just putting smaller little red schoolhouses in every locality. I don't think we're going to be able to afford to do that. I think that education is going to sort of flame out, and that we'll see homeschooling sort of begin to take its place, and it will aggregate, and you'll get homeschooling groups that will turn into schools, more or less. I think that that's the scenario that will likely happen. It's hard to say what institutions will survive. You know, it's possible that quite a few of them will, but I'm a little pessimistic about the large state-supported mega universities. Those are the ones that I think are the least likely to survive.
But does it make sense to keep putting more money and time into like the education of the system that we're in? Or,
well, that's the problem with the previous investment trap. Is you're getting an awful lot of information from your environment that things seem to be staying pretty much the same. So you should expect them to continue to be the same. And that's a reasonable expectation based on the lights are on. You know, if it was January, this room would be heated, you know, by 2006 standards anyway. So you're getting a lot of information that there's no problem. You know, that the big ship is tooting along, and it's on course, and you should stay with the ship. And so I think it's understandable. But, you know, other people may be making different decisions. They may be saying, well, you know, maybe I ought to position myself to do something a little different. Maybe I ought to become a Waldorf teacher or a Montessori teacher or start my own school look at something more local or get more into primary education rather than, you know, the later stuff. It's just a thought for what it's worth.
If we go back to the situation with trains in the United States, I was reading a book to my son a few nights ago about fast trains. And, you know, he wanted to know where you were. Well, the one that goes 185 miles an hour is in France, the one that goes 200 miles an hour is in Japan, and so on. It's kind of personally embarrassing that we don't have any fast trains in this country. Given that the people in Kansas are getting their news from Fox News, and that they're not likely to get behind, politically behind, a national project of rebuilding our railroads, how do you see this coming together, this project?
I wouldn't assume that, again, you know, I wouldn't assume that just because the people in Kansas right now feel a certain way about things that they're going to continue to. We're going to be faced, first of all, I think it's a likely scenario that we're going to be faced with big problems in the aviation industry. And when we do, we're going to have trouble with the kinds of flights right now that should have been made by trains for the last 50 years. Namely, you know, the trips between Eugene and Portland, between, Louisville and Atlanta, between Cleveland and Columbus. And there's no way to get from Cleveland to Columbus now except either to drive your car or take a plane. And both of them are kind of stupid when you consider the benefits of being on a train. Now, I'm lucky in the sense that the place that I live, the one place in America, not the one place, but one of the very few places in America where there's actually fairly reliable train service, sort of on the Soviet scale. And that's from Albany, the capital of New York, to New York City. And but it is Soviet style in the sense that there's always a little suspense about whether the train is just going to stop on a siding outside of Rhinecliff for 45 minutes for no reason, or break down. In fact, I was on one last year where something happened, and we just sat on a side, not a side, sat on the track for about an hour, and it was really cold because the heat went off, and it was winter, and we were parked at like a 40-degree angle because we were in a curve. And everybody's sort of desperately holding on to it because the seats are so slippery. And finally, the Amtrak conductor comes by, sort of like a Soviet commissar, you know, and says, "They're sending a rescue engine down from Albany." You know, basically, you know, I asked him afterwards, I sought him out in another car, and I said, "Exactly what did happen?" He said, "Oh, well, the engine blew up." But, you know, one of the things about the train deal is that there's also a lot of fantasies on the part of a lot of people who want to immediately get up and running with maglev and high-speed rail and everything. You know, we have to demonstrate that we can do trains on the Bulgarian level first before we get up to the Japanese or the French level. You know, we're not up to their ankles yet.
I was just curious if you could talk a little bit about the timeline as far as this is whatever this term peak is. A lot of financial analysts say, well, 2006, as we've seen these prices go up for gasoline, it's been one of these supply and demand cycles, and we expect it to correct itself at going into 2007. I'm just curious your perspective.
I don't think that the oil situation is going to be corrected. I think the oil situation is going to remain very, very dicey and get worse. And my sense of things is that the world is at peak, that there's a lot of evidence that we cannot increase global production anymore, and that we're really at the point where demand is now exceeding the supply, and that's going to make the markets go nuts. And I think they're going to go more nuts, and I think that, you know, we're in the process of also seeing other weird things going on. Price of gold, you know, went up $28 yesterday and another $7 today. The value of the dollar has been dropping steadily against the euro for the last 2 weeks. There's beginning to be visible inflation in just household, you know, products and stuff, in a way that hasn't, it's been exceeding what we've seen in the last several years. So that's just the beginning, I think. And then there's the whole question of the housing bubble economy, which clearly there's something going on out there, and probably a lot of default on mortgages. You know, it's a little bit below the radar screen because it really does take months and months and months for banks to start taking action against delinquent loans, and they bend over backwards and try everything possible to avoid taking action. They don't want to repossess houses. They want these loans to perform. But I kind of think that by the middle of 2006, by the middle of the summer, we're going to see a whole lot more default and failure and the beginning of some serious repo out there. We'll do a few more maybe. I think you want me to sign books out there, right? Right. And I think what I'll do is I'll just go out there to their table out there, and if you want to buy a book, I'll be glad to sign it with your Heinberg. So that has some credibility. I can't hear you.
You talk about the national scale?
Yeah.
And my question is, if you have any thoughts about the global scale, and things are so dismal as it is in Africa.
Yeah, there's a lot of dismalness out there.
Well, but just even specifically with relation to wars, if you have any
ideas
about that.
I think that, wars are the kind of heat that's produced by the friction between groups that are struggling and clashing and contesting for resources and getting in each other's faces. And I think there's plenty of potential for a lot of trouble out there. And that's not a great thought, but, probably everybody in this room is aware of that. Really all bets are off about what could happen over the next 12 months with Iran, with Venezuela, with some terrible act of terrorism that could occur anywhere in the world, really. The world's a dangerous place.
That was James Howard Kunstler, author of The Long Emergency and other books, speaking last May in Eugene, Oregon.
It can happen in a moment. Sometimes it does, when what could be is and what shouldn't be was. There are times when you gotta stand steady. There are other times when you gotta be ready. The window can open, seems so wide, can never tell when it's gonna slam shut. One day you're a target on the firing ranges, the next day all of a sudden everything changes. When it all comes crashing down. It's easy to feel like you're standing still, then the scene is revealed. You're on top of the hill. At that point, you know you can let it go by, or spread your wings and take to the sky. When it all comes crashing down. Sometimes all that's real is what you do. Some moments are coming, others have came, and then there are those when you just gotta take aim. When it all comes crashing down. When it all comes crashing.
And speaking of education appropriate to the long emergency, we continue with our ongoing readings on self-education, homeschooling, and a critique of compulsory schooling in America with John Taylor Gatto. Gatto is a former award-winning New York City public school teacher who, after 3 decades, decided that the schools were damaging intellect and character rather than building them. Last week, we began a new section in the book, in which Gatto talks about the conscious social engineering goals of the leading figures in American compulsory schooling. We'll pick up in Chapter 5, True Believers and the Unspeakable Chautauqua. True believers are only one component of American schooling. As a fraction, probably a small one, but they constitute a tail that wags the dog because they possess a blueprint and access to policy machinery, while most of the rest of us do not. The true believers we call great educators, Kamensky, Mather, Pestalozzi, Froebel, Mann, Dewey, Sears, Cubberley, Thorndike et al., were ideologues looking for a religion to replace one they never had or had lost faith in. As an abstract type, men like this have been analyzed by some of the finest minds in the history of modern thought, Machiavelli, Tocqueville, Renan, William James, to name a few. But the clearest profile of the type was set down by Eric Hoffer, a one-time migrant farm worker who didn't learn to read until he was 15 years old. In The True Believer, a luminous modern classic, Hoffer tells us, quote, "Though ours is a godless age, it is the very opposite of irreligious. The true believer is everywhere on the march, shaping the world in his own image. Whether we line up with him or against him, it is well we should know all we can concerning his nature and potentialities." Close quote. It looks to me as if the energy to run this train was released in America from the stricken body of New England Calvinism when its theocracy collapsed from indifference, ambition, and the hostility of its own children. At the beginning of the 19th century, shortly after we became a nation, this energy gave rise to what Alan Bloom dubbed the New American Religion, eventually combining elements of old Calvinism with flavors of Anabaptism, ranting, leveling, Quakerism, rationalism, positivism, and that peculiar Unitarian spice, scientism. Where the parent form of American Calvinism had preached the rigorous exclusion of all but a tiny handful deemed predestinated for salvation, the famous saints or justified sinners, the descendant faith, beginning about the time of the Great Awakening in the 1740s, demanded universal inclusion, recruitment of everyone into a universal Unitarian salvation, whether they would be so recruited or not. It was a monumental shift, which in time infiltrated every American institution. In its demand for eventual planetary unity, the operating logic of this hybrid religion, which derived from a medley of Protestant sects as well as from Judaism, in a cosmic irony, was intensely Catholic right down to its core. After the Unitarian takeover of Harvard in 1805, Orthodox Calvinism seemingly reached the end of its road, but so much explosive energy had been tightly bound into this intense form of sacred thought, an intensity which made every act, however small, brim with significance, every expression of personality proclaim an election or damnation, that in its structural collapse, a ferocious energy was released, a tornado that flashed across the burned-over district of upstate New York, crossing the lakes to Michigan and other Germanized outposts of North America, where it split suddenly into two parts. One racing westward to California and the Northwest Territories, another turning southwest to the Mexican colony called Texas. Along the way, Calvin's by now much altered legacy deposited new religions like Mormonism and Seventh-day Adventism, raised colleges like the University of Michigan and Michigan State, which would later become fortresses of the new schooling religion, and left prisons, insane asylums, Indian reservations, and poor houses in its wake as previews of the secularized global village it aimed to create. School was to be the temple of a new all-inclusive civil religion. Calvinism had stumbled, finally from being too self-contained. This new American form, learning from Calvinism's failure, aspired to become a multicultural super-system, world-girdling in the fullness of time. Our recent military invasions of Haiti, Panama, Iraq, the Balkans, and Afghanistan, redolent of the palmy days of British Empire, cannot be understood from the superficial justifications offered. Yet with an eye to Calvin's legacy, even foreign policy yields some of its secret springs. Calvinist origins armed schoolthinkers from the start with a utilitarian contempt for the notion of free will. Brain control experiments being explored in the psychophysical labs of northern Germany in the last quarter of the 19th century attracted rich young men from thousands of prominent American families. Such mind science seemed to promise that tailor-made technologies could emerge to shape and control thought, technologies which had never existed before. Children, the new psychology suggested, could be emptied, denatured, then reconstructed to more accommodating designs. H.G. Wells' Island of Dr. Moreau was an extrapolation fable based on common university-inspired drawing-room conversations of the day. David Hume's empirical philosophy, working together with John Locke's empiricism, had prepared the way for social thinkers to see children as blank slates, an opinion predominant among influentials long before the Civil War, and implicit in Machiavelli, Bowdoin, and the Bacons. German psychophysics and physiological psychology seemed a wonderful manufactory of the tools a good political surgeon needed to make the modern world. Methods for modifying society and all its inhabitants began to crystallize from the insights of the laboratory. A good living could be made by saying it was so, even if it weren't true. When we examine the new American teacher college movement at the turn of the century, we discover a resurrection of the methodology of Prussian philosopher Herbart, well underway. Although Herbart had been dead a long time by then, he had the right message for the new age. According to Herbart, children should be cut to fit. And I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. A bountiful source of clues to what tensions were actually at work back then can be found in Elwood P. Cubberley's celebratory history, Public Education in the United States, 1919, revised edition, 1934. The standard in-house reference for official school legends until revisionist writings appeared in the 1960s. Cubberley was an insider's insider in a unique position to know things neither public nor press could know. Although Cubberley always is circumspect and deliberately vague, he cannot help revealing more than he wants to. For example, the reluctance of the country to accept its new yoke of compulsion is caught briefly in this flat statement on page 564 of the 1934 revision. Quote, "The history of compulsory attendance legislation in the states has been much the same everywhere, and everywhere laws have been enacted only after overcoming strenuous opposition." Close quote. Reference here is to the period from 1852 to 1918, when the states, one by one, were caught in a compulsion net that used the strategy of gradualism. At first, the laws were optional. Later, the law was made statewide, but the compulsory period was short, 10 to 12 weeks, and the age limits low, 9 to 12 years. After this, struggle came to extend the time, often little by little, to extend the age limits downward to 8 and 7 and upwards to 14, 15, or 16, to make the law apply to children attending private or parochial schools, and to require cooperation from such schools for the proper handling of cases, to institute state supervision of local enforcement, to connect school attendance enforcement with the child labor legislation of the state through a system of working permits. Noteworthy is the extent to which proponents of centralized schooling were prepared to act covertly in defiance of majority will and in the face of extremely successful and inexpensive local school heritage. As late as 1901, after nearly half a century of such legislation, first in Massachusetts, then state by state in the majority of the remaining jurisdictions, Dr. Levi Seeley of Trenton Normal School could still thunder warnings of lack of progress. In his book, Foundations of Education, he writes, "While no law on the statute books of Prussia is more thoroughly carried out than compulsory attendance," he laments that in 1890, out of 5,300,000 Prussian children, only 645 slipped out of the truant officer's net, but that our own school attendance legislation is nothing more than dead-letter laws. We have been attempting compulsory education for a whole generation and cannot be said to have made much progress. Let us cease to require only 20 weeks of schooling, 12 of which shall be consecutive, thus plainly hinting that we are not serious in the matter." Close quote. Seeley's frustration clouded his judgment. Somebody was most certainly serious about mass confinement schooling. To stay at it so relentlessly and expensively in the face of massive public repudiation of the scheme. The center of the scheme was Massachusetts, the closest thing to a theocracy to have emerged in America. The list below is a telling record of the long gap between the Massachusetts compulsory law of 1852 and similar legislation adopted by the next set of states. Instructive also in the chronology is the place taken by the District of Columbia, the seat of federal government. And here Agatto provides a list of states and dates, which is kind of tedious for radio reading, but it should be pointed out that the District of Columbia was the second area to adopt the compulsory school legislation. That was in 1865. Vermont followed in 1867. New York, Kansas, and California in 1874. With Ohio in 1877. And the Dakotas, Montana, Illinois, and Rhode Island in 1883. Six other western states and territories were added by 1890. Finally, in 1918, 66 years after the Massachusetts force legislation, the 48th state, Mississippi, enacted a compulsory school attendance law. Keep in mind Coverley's words. Everywhere there was strenuous opposition. But a strange thing happened as more and more children were drawn into the net, a crisis of an unexpected sort. At first, those primitive one-room and two-room compulsion schools, and even the large new secondary schools like Philadelphia Central High, poured out large numbers of trained, disciplined intellects. Government school teachers in those early days chose overwhelmingly to emulate the standards of private academies, and to a remarkable degree they succeeded in unwittingly sabotaging the hierarchical plan being moved in online. Without a carefully trained administrative staff, and most American schools had no administrators, it proved impossible to impose the dumbing-down process promised by the German prototype. In addition, right through the 1920s, a skilled apprenticeship alternative was active in the United States, traditional training that still honored our national mythology of success. Ironically, the first crisis provoked by the new school institution was taking its rhetorical mandate too seriously. From it poured an abundance of intellectually trained minds at exactly the moment when the national economy of independent livelihoods and democratic workplaces was giving way to professionally managed, accountant-driven, hierarchical corporations which needed no such people. The typical graduate of a one-room school represented a force antithetical to the logic of corporate life, a cohort inclined to judge leadership on its merit, one reluctant to confer authority on mere titles. Immediate action was called for. Cubberly's celebratory history doesn't examine motives, but it does uneasily record forceful steps taken just inside the new century to nip the career of intellectual schooling for the masses in the bud, replacing it with a different goal, the forging of well-adjusted citizens. Quote, since 1900, and due more to the activity of persons concerned with social legislation and those interested in improving the moral welfare of children than to educators themselves, there has been a general revision of the compulsory education laws of our states and the enactment of much new child welfare and anti-child labor legislation. These laws have brought into the schools not only the truant and the incorrigible, who under former conditions either left early or were expelled, but also many children who have no aptitude for book learning, and many children of inferior mental qualities who do not profit by ordinary classroom procedures. Our schools have come to contain many children who become a nuisance in the school and tend to demoralize school procedure. Close quote. We're not going to get much closer to running face-to-face into the true believers and the self-interested parties who imposed forced schooling than in Cubberly's mysterious persons concerned with social legislation. At about the time Cubberly refers to, Walter Jessup, president of the University of Iowa, was publicly complaining, quote, "Now America demands we educate the whole. It is a much more difficult problem to teach all children than to teach those who want to learn." Close quote. Common sense should tell you it isn't difficult to teach children who don't want to learn. It's impossible. Common sense should tell you America was demanding nothing of the sort. But somebody most certainly was insisting on universal indoctrination in class subordination. The forced attendance of children who want to be elsewhere, learning in a different way, meant the short, happy career of academic public schooling was deliberately foreclosed, with democracy used as the excuse. The new inclusive pedagogy effectively doomed the bulk of American children. What you should take away from this is the deliberate introduction of children who, quote, demoralize school procedure, children who were accommodated prior to this legislation in a number of other productive and by no means inferior forms of training, just as Benjamin Franklin had been. Richard Hofstadter and other social historians have mistakenly accepted at face value official claims that democratic tradition, the will of the people, imposed this anti-intellectual diet on the classroom. Democracy had nothing to do with it. What we are up against is a strategic project supported by an uneasy coalition of elites, each with its own private goals in mind for the common institution. Among those goals was the urge to go to war against diversity, to impose orthodoxy on heterodox society. For an important clue to how this was accomplished, we return to Cubberly. Quote, "The school reorganized its teaching along lines dictated by the new psychology of instruction which had come to us from abroad. Beginning about 1880 to 1885, our schools began to experience a new but steady change in purpose, though it is only since about 1900 that any marked and rapid changes have set in." Close quote. The new psychology of instruction cited here is the new experimental psychology of Wilhelm Wundt at Leipzig, which dismissed the very existence of mind as an epiphenomenon. Children were complex machines capable of infinite adjustments. Here was the beginning of that new and unexpected genus of schooling which Balin said troubled, well-disposed, high-minded people, and which elevated a new class of technocrat like Cubberley and Dewey to national prominence. The intention to sell schooling as a substitute for faith is caught clearly in Cubberley's observation, quote, "However much we have lost interest in the old problems of faith and religion, the American people have come to believe thoroughly in education." Close quote. New subjects replace the old limited book subject curriculum, both elementary and secondary. This was done despite the objections of many teachers and citizens and much ridicule from the public press. Many spoke sneeringly of the new subjects. Cubberley provides an accurate account of the prospective new city on the hill for which public education was to be a prelude, a city which rose hurriedly after the failed populist revolt of 1896 frightened industrial leaders. I've selected 6 excerpts from Cubberley's celebrated history, which will allow you to see, through an insider's eyes, the game that was afoot a century ago, as U.S. school training was being fitted for its German uniform. 1. The Spanish-American War of 1898 served to awaken us as a nation. It revealed to us something of the position we should be called to occupy in world affairs. And just a reminder, he's quoting from Cubberley. This is not Gatto's opinion. The second excerpt from Cubberley. For the 2 decades following, the specialization of labor and the introduction of labor-saving machinery took place to an extent before unknown. The national and state government were called upon to do many things for the benefit of the people never attempted before. And next, since 1898, education has awakened a public interest before unknown. Everywhere, state educational commissions and city school surveys have evidenced a new critical attitude. Much new educational legislation has been enacted. Permission has been changed to obligation. Minimum requirements have been laid down by the states in many new directions, and new subjects of instruction have been added by the law. Courses of study have been entirely made over, and new types of textbooks have appeared. A complete new system of industrial education, national in scope, has been developed. And new normal schools have been founded and higher requirements have been ordered for those desiring to teach. College departments of education have increased from 11 in 1891 to something like 500 today, 1919. Private gifts to colleges and universities have exceeded anything known before in any land. School taxes have been increased, old school funds more carefully guarded, and new constitutional provisions as to education have been added. Compulsory education has begun to be a reality, and child labor laws to be enforced. A new interest in child welfare and child hygiene has arisen, evidencing commendable desire to look after the bodies as well as the minds of children. Close quote. That from Cubberley. Now back to Gatto. Here, in a brief progression, is one window on the problem of modern schooling. It set out to build a new social order at the beginning of the 20th century, and by 1970 had succeeded beyond all expectations. But in the process, it crippled the democratic experiment of America, disenfranchising ordinary people, dividing families, creating wholesale dependencies, grotesquely extending childhoods. It emptied people of full humanity in order to convert them into human resources. And I've been reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. We'll continue with more from that next time. To find out more about John Taylor Gatto, he has a website at johntaylorgatto.com. Gatto is spelled G-A-T-T-O. You can download this book there at his website. And you can download this and all of our shows online at oursunwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening.
You still catch me napping one day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end. For my guns and my